She has not yet said she will do so. The American Academy of Pediatrics also opposes the bill and urged Ivy to veto it. Mainstream medical and mental health professionals say gender-affirming care saves lives by reducing the risk of depression and suicide. More than 1,000 book titles, most addressing racism and LGBTQ issues, have been banned from U.S. classrooms and school libraries in the last 9 months, according to a new report from the writers' organization PEN America. PEN compiled a database of banned books that includes the first novel by Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison. 42 children's books were censored, including biographies of Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., Duke Ellington, Sonia Sotomayor, and Nelson Mandela. PEN America says the widespread censorship is unparalleled in its intensity and frequency and represents a serious threat to free expression and students' First Amendment rights. Also this week, the American Library Association published its annual report on book censorship, revealing it had tracked 1,597 book challenges or removals in 2021. That's the highest number recorded since the association began tracking the phenomenon 20 years ago. And New York Attorney General Letitia James on Thursday asked a court to hold former President Trump in civil contempt for allegedly refusing to hand over documents for her investigation of his business practices. A state judge in February ordered Trump to comply in full with James's subpoenas, but in her motion filed yesterday, James said Trump did not comply at all with the subpoena for documents and asked the court to impose a fine of $10,000 a day until he does. The investigation led by James is focused on allegations that the Trump Organization artificially altered the value of its assets for financial gain. In related news, the Justice Department has begun investigating the handling of 15 boxes of White House records, including classified information, taken to Mar-a-Lago after former President Trump left office, a source familiar with the matter told CNN yesterday. And in weather today, in Washington, it is 58 degrees and sunny. In New York City, 54 degrees and sunny. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
University researchers found that zinc deficiency in cell cultures in aged mice, and it really is not cool because then you allow what are called cytokines, I-N-T-E-R-L-E-U-K-I-N, 1-beta, and interleukin 6. These are inflammatory cytokines, and they're not good. You don't want a cytokine storm. And frequently after surgery or radiation treatment or alcohol consumption, you end up with inflammatory responses all over the body. Just have a cup of coffee and you end up with inflammatory responses in your stomach. So helping to prevent inflammation is at the bedrock of helping to prevent a whole lot of disease. And something as simple as zinc, 15 to 25 milligrams a day, will help stop that. You see, you want to have zinc because of the administration of an inflammatory provoking substance to human white blood cells in a study known as monocytes, and zinc is not there to help you. Well, when you have zinc, when you're taking a supplement or making sure you're eating zinc-rich foods, you have it. That's good. Another good thing to have on a regular basis, and many people around the world do, especially in India and in many of the subcontinents, it's called turmeric, T-U-R. M-E-R-I-C. Now, generally speaking, at least where I came from, no one ever had turmeric in anything. And yet, my office in mid-Manhattan is within walking distance of the Indian food centers, little stores, regular little tiny stores, and they're loaded down on Lexington Avenue in the 20s, around 27th Street, with all kinds of spices and multiple types of spices. How many different cinnamons are you aware of? They have all of them and different seasonings. So it really adds a different type of taste to your dishes. But it's good for you. Why? Because inside turmeric, there is a compound I've mentioned many times. It is called curcumin. C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N. Curcumin. Now, curcumin has thousands of studies showing how it helps empower your immune system, has anti-cancer properties, antiviral properties, helps the body heal. But now there's something new. Turmeric helps grow engineered blood vessels and tissues, according to University of California at Riverside. According to them, the bioengineers could hasten development of lab-grown blood vessels and other tissues to replace and regenerate damaged tissues in human patients. Now, curcumin, a compound, as I mentioned, found in turmeric, has anti-inflammatory, antioxidant properties, and is known to suppress angiogenesis, which is what feeds malignant tumors. And the bioengineers at the University of California at Riverside have now discovered that when delivered through magnetic, what are called hydrogels, into stem cell cultures, this versatile compound, curcumin, paradoxically also promotes the secretion of vascular endothelial growth factor that helps vascular tissue grow. And when cultured with stem cells derived from bone marrow, the magnetic hydrogel gradually releases the curcumin into the injury of the cells. So, in scientific terms, it's got some protein in it, amino acids, but it doesn't have the essential oils, doesn't have the real fiber that everyone's health improved. And he called not having healthy enzymes, and I'll bet he was also referring, though we didn't know at the time, of the probiotics, good bacteria. And he called it the saccharine disease. In any case, this is just showing that you can prevent colorectal cancer. You can help turn off inflammation and help the DNA get reduced in its damage and repaired. One of the most important berries is pomegranate. Now, if you've ever gotten fresh pomegranate, it's very red and firm and heavy. If it's soft and mushy, don't buy it. It means overripe. So when you cut it open, you see all these beautiful red orbs. And then when you put them into a smoothie or glass, juice them or eat them, you can taste the slightly bitter juice coming out. Well, that pomegranate is really a superstar. It would be one of the top five fruits that I would recommend on a daily basis. So the new study from Technion Israeli Institute of Technology is it really helps keep the doctor away. So let's add an apple a day, yeah? Keeps the doctor away. But pomegranate a day also keeps the doctor away. Whole pomegranate. I grow pomegranates, and it's really terrific to go out and pick them. By the way, I always pick up ground fruit, and here's why. This is just a little, for all of you living in California, Texas, other states where you can grow citrus. The whole idea that we go out and harvest our citrus when it gets ripe, don't do that. In fact, right now, I still have lemons, oranges, and pomelo and grapefruit and limes on the tree from the fall. Yeah, 9 months later. In fact, I've actually gone a whole year where I have a few of the citrus left on the tree where the new ones are ripening at the same time. And I always take the ones that fall. So when they fall on the ground, that's when they're the ripest and have the most water content, are the sweetest. And so I pick them up. Anyhow, I had this huge bowl one morning just so happens out of pineapple because I was growing pineapples. Easy to grow a pineapple, by the way. You just take the existing pineapple, cut the top of it off, leave about 2 inches, and plant that in the ground. So the part that you would never eat is the part that grows a new pineapple. Takes a while. It takes about a year. They're long growing. But in any case, and this morning I had about 15 different types of fruit, including a jackfruit. No, jackfruit can get big. I've seen pictures of jackfruit that are about 5 feet long, hanging on trees in the subcontinent. But mine was about 27 pounds. It was about, if you're watching right now, it was about this big as a watermelon. It has a bubblegum smell and taste to it. And so I get some of it fresh, eat some of it fresh, very chewy. It's the kind of thing that you can chew on for about a half hour before you can swallow it. But what is really good is to dry them. Now, most people know about getting a food dehydrator. It can dehydrate at about 115 degrees, which means it's still a living raw food. That's how a lot of the raw food companies make their granolas and pizza crusts and things that they want to sell as raw and still living, healthy, but still have a difference in their mouthfeel and consistency, more crispy. In any case, you can dry all the fruits out there. I don't dry oranges, lemons, limes. No, there's too much water and you get too little. But I do dry peaches, nectarines, pomegranate. I can dry mulberries, which are in season now. And it's fun to pick mulberries and just to chew them right then and there. But I also give them to all the animals. They love that. It's a treat. So I'm doing a little video now, and I'm going to post it in the near future, showing you how, no matter where you live, you could live in Alaska, how you can grow fruit year-round indoors. Raspberries, strawberries, yeah, even watermelon. So I've created some new ways of growing things, no matter how harsh the conditions. And instead of just going out and planting some seeds in the ground and watching them get flooded out, eaten out by birds, or dried out. And so a whole new bunch of information coming at you. But in any case, a friend posted that, and people found it interesting. But they couldn't imagine all that just came from that day. Well, I have over, let's see, at this point I must have 43 different types of fruit growing. So they grow at different times. And based on fertilizing them, yesterday was fertilizing the fruit trees, you can have cherries grow 3 times in a year, especially if you have bees. And I have bees. They wait patiently every morning. I go out and I feed them raw, organic, unfiltered honey. You smear it out on a board and you make it even so they don't get stuck in it. And then you see all the bees just waiting and boom, they go right in on it. By the way, never stung either in all the years of maintaining bees, but that bee is going to pollinate that fruit tree. And that's one way that you can have urban bees and have fruit growing. It'll pollinate all the things it can pollinate. But for all the people living up in Montana and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Idaho, and you see a lot of bees die, and then what do you feed them? You feed them glucose. Don't feed them glucose. That's wrong. And don't spray the neonicotinoid pesticides. It kills them. In mass, it kills them. And don't truck any more bees out to California to the almond orchards than have them starve out there because the stress of them going on those long trips in the cold weather, it has a huge bee kill-off. Instead, let your bees eat their own honey. If you do that, they're going to stick around. They won't swarm. They won't go off property to try to look for food. And what do you think a bee is eating when it's winter? There's nothing that's giving them any pollen. There's nothing giving them the nectar. So you have to give them back their honey. And that's important. Just a little advice, because a lot of people are getting hives now for their properties, and good for them. But the honey is for the bees, not for you. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Knoll. And remember, tomorrow at noon, we're going to have a conference call. It's free. It's not a webinar. It's not a lecture. I'm going to be answering a lot of the mail that people have sent. We've gotten flooded with information. We're talking about hundreds of requests. They don't want to live where they're living, whether it's New York or New Jersey and Connecticut or California, among other places. But those are the primary places. Where can they live based upon, and then they have a long criteria. Okay, I looked at all the criteria, and then I thought, well, the best place to live, unless you're willing to go out and buy some land and start your own homestead, but I've already done that several times, and I believe that that's not what most people want to do today or can do. So what are the best places to live? Even if you don't want to live in a community as such, you don't want a house because you're not sure of the future, then I'm going to talk about also mobile homes, you know, RVs. You can live in different places depending upon what your needs are and move on. So I'm going to talk about the best places to live with intentional communities. There are over 1,000 intentional communities in the United States, and they're all different. So I'm going to lay them out, and then you decide if this, you know, where you want to go in the future. Some people are already making their moves and regret their moves because they all went to North Carolina or the place they thought would be terrific, and those are not the best places. There's a lot of reasons to be there, a lot of reasons not to be there. You have to weigh these things. So I've done a lot of traveling, a lot of research, and I'm going to be doing that conference call. Now, to get the number for the conference call, simply look on Peerin Live, and they'll have it for you, or GaryKnoll.com, or worst case scenario, call Sharon. I prefer people not to call her because she gets calls all day long in our New York office at 646-926-5422. Back in a moment. A lot more to share with you. Welcome back, everyone. We have an interesting guest. Interesting in that I'm not aware of any other scientist, and he is a scientist, and he's a medical doctor, and he's also a lawyer, who has done the type of methodical forensic research to address a basic question. The basic question is this. Was the coronavirus that has caused so much damage, was it engineered? And if so, where? And how do we know? What's the proof? Because one whole group of scientists surrounding Anthony Fauci says, no, it came from nature. But now we're seeing that that is being challenged. Every week we're getting another report, putting another piece of the puzzle together. But what if we have a whole puzzle? My guest will show us how much he knows that the world needs to know. He is Dr. Richard Fleming. He's a board-certified cardiologist specializing in nuclear medicine who has proven a direct correlation between inflammation and heart disease, a major discovery. He holds a PhD in particle physics. He graduated from the University of Iowa College of Medicine and later completed a law degree. He's the inventor of the Fleming method for tissue and vascular differentiation and metabolism, a method that quantifies tissue activity due to inflammation and infection. In the past, he's taught at the University of Texas and conducted cardiological research at Methodist College and Creighton University. Since the declaration of COVID pandemic, he has put his attention on uncovering the health risks for both the SARS-2 virus and the COVID-19 vaccines, exposing the medical risks just being honest, looking at the literature, and also looking at the clinical experience, something that the news media has kept out of the equation. For example, when was the last time you saw that the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, or anyone else, anyone, actually went into the offices of those clinicians who are in the front lines, in the intensive care, in the hospital settings, and saw what are they doing from the very beginning to save lives? Because if this story were told, then it would raise two questions. If these doctors, and there are many, not just Dr. Corey and Dr. McDonough, but a lot more, if these doctors were indeed helping patients get back their health so they didn't have to go to the hospital, they didn't need the ICU treatments, then why wasn't this shared so all the other people can have the benefit of early treatment? What were they using? They were using FDA-approved off-label drugs. And we're talking about thousands upon thousands of patients from board-certified, highly respected, non-controversial pro-vaccine doctors. Not one single instance was this done. And yet in the FDA standards of determining the safety and efficacy of anything, clinical experience is always required too. Clinical experience has been shut out completely. Because if you had clinical experience in showing drugs, whether it was monoclonal antibodies or steroids or ivermectin, vitamin D, vitamin C, quercetin, helping a patient, then they could not have justified the emergency use to get these vaccines into the marketplace. So we're going to ask our guest about this. Oh, by the way, he's published over, well, he's edited several medical textbooks, 60 peer-reviewed scientific papers. He's released a new book called Is COVID a Bioweapon? A Scientific and Forensic Investigation, which takes a hard, honest, critical look at the available evidence that identifies clear genetic anomalies that could only have occurred through gain-of-function research. Dr. Fleming's website is FlemingMethod.com. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be here, Gary. Thank you for the invitation.
It now seems certain that the spike protein of the SARS-2 virus is the Rosetta Stone for its pathogenicity and for unlocking the virus's origins. Now, the question is whether natural coronaviruses found in bats can infect humans through the ACE2 receptors, which are found in tissue cells throughout your body, and whether these natural viral infections can be transmitted from human to human. We already know that it is the RNA-coded spike protein in the vaccines that are contributing to the hundreds of various adverse events, and we're observing almost all the time in the vaccinated. It is the spike protein, it is the toxin. But to make the leap that a bat virus has the genetic means to infect humans the way we have seen during the past 2.5 years is an occurrence through natural mutation. Is that possible? Well, Fauci says yes. What do you say on this? Try to take us now on your story, your journey of seeing how the pathogenicity can only be accounted for if the virus was genetically engineered, and that is the center of the debate. Therefore, we need to know the fingerprints for the SARS genetic sequence that can account for this, and you've unlocked that. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. You know, when December 2019 happened and it became obvious that we were going to have a pandemic with a virus, in January of 2020, I set out to investigate what drugs would be useful for viruses, what mechanisms of action they would have, and I established a national clinical trial and began that research of which drugs worked and what combinations. And simultaneously then, to try to better understand that, I began investigating, along with the assistance of many people around the world, the unique characteristics of this virus called severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2 or SARS-CoV-2. And I knew from the prior work, as you mentioned, that viruses can produce an inflammatory thrombotic or an inflammation and blood clotting response causing a disease, and that's what's called COVID-19. But to understand it, I needed to look into the specific ways in which this spike protein actually attached to cells and got into cells to understand what treatments would and would not work. And the investigation of that spike protein itself led to the unmasking of federal monies that were paid out over the series of decades, who those monies were paid out to, where they came from, what published research was in the literature already for any of us to see if we had gone to investigate it, what patents had been granted demonstrating intellectual property recognized by the U.S. government and international patents, and how they played into this specific coronavirus. Much of the fingerprinting pointed back to the United States, to the Department of Defense, to Health and Human Services, to the National Institutes of Health, to the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Disease, and multiple other federal agencies. I can tell you not only in the investigation of this, but I can tell you from emails that I have received in an effort to recruit me as a physicist to be involved in the imaging of coronaviruses funded by NIAID through Fort Detrick. I can tell you personally, I have received emails trying to recruit me for those positions, which tells you right up front that Fort Detrick, DOD, NIAID is all involved in coronavirus research. Now, the data is painful in some regards when you look at it, because it's been going on for decades, and you can watch how methodically multiple universities, but the people whose names keep coming to the top are Peter Daszak at EcoHealth and Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina, and Xi Zhang Li at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And if you read through a couple decades worth of research, and this is in the book, and we're going to talk about it on the Crimes Against Humanity tour that begins in Fort Myers, Florida, on the 23rd of this month, so 2 weeks from tomorrow, 2 weeks from today, I'll be traveling. I'm going to walk you through so you can see that these individuals in this funding took a little bit more than two decades, where Barrick's original work was in transmissible gastroenteritis virus, or TGEF. But you can see how his research changed over time as he became more interested in coronaviruses because of their ease of manipulation. And you can see the research where Xi Zhang Li, early on, took bat viruses that were unable to infect humans and modified them with the introduction of an HIV pseudovirus with glycoprotein 120 to make the spike protein of that virus, known as HKU4, capable of infecting people, and successfully turned a virus that was unable to infect people into a virus that was able to infect people. And serial publications taken over those decades show how they continue to manipulate the coronaviruses to increase the infectivity. Now, a lot of people have started talking in the past few months about they took the spike protein of one virus and the backbone of another virus and put it together. But the truth is they did much, much more than that. They actually went in and individually changed specific nucleotide bases or genetic code of these viruses in five specific spots, including the envelope protein, which is critical for the ability of this virus to infect people. When you look at a virus and you ask, is this a zoonotic or naturally occurring virus, you have to find an animal host or reservoir. And in addition to the fact that we have all this data about the manipulation of these viruses and increasing their infectivity and increasing their pathogenicity or ability to cause harm, what we also see is absolutely no evidence, no animal reservoir for either SARS-CoV-2 or SARS-CoV-1. Now, SARS-CoV-2 a lot of people would tell you was first detected in 2019, but if you go back to 2006, there's a paper published by the group of Chinese researchers where they put together four viruses: hepatitis C virus, HIV virus, what they literally called SARS-CoV-1 at the time, because then they also inserted SARS-CoV-2 at the time. So they made a new virus just combining those four viruses together back in 2006. So we know their fingerprints are all over this back to 2006. We also saw very clearly that the Wuhan Institute of Virology received a tremendous amount of help from the United States in the building not only of this biological lab, which is a biological weapons facility when you think about it, but Fort Detrick was actively involved in the development of this virus, and then at a point in time, the United States decided we'd better get out of gain-of-function research, you know, the research that gains the function or the ability of a virus to infect or cause harm to people. So the Obama administration decided along the way that we were going to put a moratorium. Now, they didn't do that out of the goodness of their heart. They did that because physicians and scientists got very nervous from the fact that there were multiple gain-of-function viruses, including avianic flu and a variety of other viruses that they'd been working on that had gotten out uncontrolled and done some harm and kind of exposed what was going on. So they wanted to put the lid on that. But at the same time that they were putting a lid on that in the United States, what we now see, thanks to the Ukraine conflict, is that the United States started investing huge amounts of money building biological weapons facilities around the world, including in the Ukraine, where at least eight of those facilities in the Ukraine are completely under the control of the Department of Defense, our Department of Defense, not the Ukrainian Department of Defense. So we have now been able to expose over 300 biolabs around the world that the United States has put into place where they are looking at viruses and bacteria and modifying those and playing with those. We have the patents that very clearly show that NIAID, Dr. Fauci's group, paid for specific gain-of-function virus changes to the spike protein of coronaviruses. So for Dr. Fauci to sit in front of Senator Dr. Rand Paul under oath and say, well, we don't fund gain-of-function research. And now the latest ploy is, well, we're going to change the definition of what gain-of-function is so that we can say, well, no, that's not gain-of-function anymore. This shows not only two decades worth of funded research and actual published outcomes of making viruses more infective, causing disease, harming people, and releasing these viruses over, again, at least two decades. But the book takes you back many more decades than that, so you can see how all of this started to develop. Back to the time of HIV, you know, Luc Montagnier, before he passed away, and I were looking, because I was a medical student when HIV happened, and he and I were working on the issue that much of the work that I've done in the past that got the federal government all stressed out had to do with work that I was doing with inflammation, and I was working with issues on a Nrf5ac receptor, which is how these different inflammatory changes occur in human cells. Well, it turns out that Nrf5ac receptor is also the site that Xi Zhang Li was looking at when she was putting HIV glycoprotein 120 into these HKU4 spike proteins, because that component of HIV not only causes prion diseases, so diseases like mad cow disease or Alzheimer's diseases or cardiac diseases called amyloidosis, that attachment site, which is a sialic acid receptor receptor site, is critical for getting this spike protein to then swing into the ACE2 receptor, where it then crosses and begins to be broken down by what's called the TMPRSS2, or transmembrane protein serialase 2 site, that starts to break apart that spike protein and bring the virus into the cell. And then the next critical step is what's called the furin, F-U-R-I-N, cleavage site. Now, this is critical because that furin cleavage site, not only does the U.S. federal government own the patent to those enzyme systems, but that furin cleavage, which is a set of four amino acids, proline, arginine, and alanine, happen to be four amino acids that exist in this spike protein that do not exist in any other coronavirus on the planet. Out of the blue, this virus has four amino acids at one site, which is 12 nucleotide bases, and mutations occur one at a time. So 12 nucleotide bases, four amino acids that are critical to getting this virus into the cell, and the U.S. government owns the patent rights to this enzyme system. And the published papers show that this is critical to the infectivity of this virus. We also know from Professor Montagnier's work, and as I said, he and I were working on the fact that in the early days of HIV, you know, there's this confusion between HIV and AIDS and SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. And much is made of mixing these terms together, and it's important to separate these out because they're not the same thing. COVID-19 is not the virus. It's the disease. AIDS is not the virus. It's the disease. And what Professor Luke and I were talking about and looking at, and what he spent his life working on, HIV, is that there's HIV and SIV, which means simian or ape immune deficiency virus, elements throughout this spike protein that match the fact that there's this glycoprotein 120 HIV component that Xi Zhengli blatantly just says, you know, put in to the virus in an effort to increase the infectivity of it. And we know that this has resulted in people, you know, in New Zealand, they were shocked, I think. And the question should be, well, why were the New Zealand people looking for this and others were not? But in New Zealand, when the vaccine started rolling out, they were finding HIV, evidence of HIV infection in people that were getting vaccinated. Much to their credit, at least somebody was paying attention on that part, perhaps not other things. But these HIV components are critical in the understanding that HIV was the first virus that we truly recognized as a retrovirus. Now, it's called reverse transcription, and it's important to cover just a few basic terms, biology terms. When DNA is turned into RNA, that process is called transcription. So reverse transcription is when RNA gets turned back into DNA. And a reverse transcription, or a reverse transcribed, or an RT virus like HIV and SARS-CoV-2, reverse transcribe, they take their genetic code and insert it into human genetic code. Now, back when Xi Zhengli started this, that wasn't known. The human genome data was not fully appreciated. So the only way to do this was to put the HIV component, the glycoprotein 120, in there for the attachment and to assist with the reverse transcription. It turns out that human cells are very good at doing that naturally. About 18% of our DNA is what's called long interspersed nucleotide elements 1, or line, L-I-N-E, 1. And that is, it's a unique capability of our genetic code to take and look at outside genetic code and say this should be incorporated into human DNA. Now, there's obviously a benefit to that, but in this case, there's obviously a detriment to that too. And in cardiology, we've known for some time that platelets that help your blood to clot, and CD4 cells that are helper cells that help with immune function are very rich in this reverse transcription ability. That's why HIV was able to hide in CD4 helper cells and then reemerge afterwards. But part of what Professor Luke and I were talking about and that he had uncovered is that when the initial AIDS patients were treated with these drugs that they're now bringing out for SARS-CoV-2, when they were treated with these protease inhibitors, then and people looked like they were getting better, and then they stopped using the protease inhibitors, the disease came back with a vengeance. And when the virus particles were looked at under electron microscopes, what was discovered is that they changed. They looked like they had lost part of their outside surface. And then these smaller particles started showing up that were making it even more infective. And those smaller particles appear to be glycoprotein 120, the same thing that we're talking about that was inserted by Xi Zhang Li into the spike protein of these coronaviruses to make it more infective. So we have the financial data, the patents, the grants. We have the published papers lining all these people together. We have the patents showing what's been accepted as intellectual property. We have emails now, thanks to people going back and forth and communicating and not being very good at hiding what they were doing. All of this evidence is pointing directly at these people, and it points to, you know, if you look into the bigger picture, not just the manipulation of this virus, but manipulation of other infectious agents, other bacteria, other viruses, an effort to use CRISPR technology to alter genetic codes of people, the fingerprints and the blood stains are some of them are dried and some of them are fresh at this point in time in the code. And the book lays it out. The affidavit that I've signed under oath lays it out. The testimony that I've given that's online lays it out, a 54-minute testimony, also done under oath, under penalty of perjury by an actual court reporter and an attorney that has argued before the Supreme Court of the United States and won. And we will be presenting that and much, much more on this Crimes of Humanity tour coming up.
Thank you for that overview. Here's the problem. A lot of what you were just saying was, though scientifically based as evidence, is not easily understood. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yes.
Good, thank you. So what we're saying is that a lot of people are thinking, okay, I'm not a scientist, I don't understand that. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions for short answers on this. Is it your opinion, and do you have the documentation to support it if the answer is yes, that this was intended to be a gain-of-function research that could also be weaponized?
Yes.
Okay. Is it true that the Communist Party also was a part of this whole process and both had input in and received information from the studies as they were occurring?
Yes.
Is it true to your awareness, and when you say yes, again, you have the evidence to support this.
Absolutely.
That Anthony Fauci and Dr. Jarek and these other people would have known that gain-of-function research was also a high risk?
Yes.
All right. Do you believe that Anthony Fauci and this whole group of people have lied when they have tried to obfuscate the issue that they had anything to do with it directly?
Yes.
All right. Are we looking at multiple federal agencies, including the Defense Department and DARPA, having a role in this? And why would they have a role unless it was to see if this could have been turned into a biological agent as a weapon? Is that reasonable or not?
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I kept those other answers brief, so let me go a little bit more in depth on this one. The United States in 1975 signed the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty, which says no agent, because this is biological warfare has existed on this planet for thousands of years. And in 1925, when the Geneva Protocol was initially written, they began the exclusion of poisonous gases and poisonous biological agents. During World War II, the only people who did that were the Nazis, and we prosecuted them for doing that. And that's what needs to be done with these people. In 1975, we signed a Biological Weapons Convention Treaty with everybody else. Now, remember, in 1975, that's when my generation walked out of Vietnam with a disappointing loss, if you will. And, you know, I think it's interesting that that was the point in time that the U.S. got behind and said, yeah, we're going to sign this agreement with everybody else. But the ability to validate that treaty, to prove that countries are not making biological weapons, you're going to see in this tour, I'm going to show you the documents where it was the United States of America that blocked the teeth for countries to investigate other countries to see whether they were or were not building these biological weapons. And despite a treaty, 30-some countries have biological weapons labs where they are continuing to develop biological weapons. Now, I don't know if you've looked at who the Department of Defense works with, but it's not the Girl Scouts. They're not selling cookies. Their perspective is, you know, the war. And you don't build biological weapons that can infect people unless you're planning to use it. Nobody builds a weapon and then says, I'm never going to use that. Nobody stockpiles a weapon because they're not going to use it. You stockpile a weapon because you're planning to use it if you need to at some point in time. And let's be very clear, these Ukrainian labs contain not just U.S., but also Russian biological agents. I mean, that's what the Russians were in there working on this stuff beforehand. But since then, you know, when Obama said, well, we're not going to do it in this country, we put up labs around the world. And, you know, these cost anywhere between $2 to $3 million a year, or $2 to $3 million per year to put up and fund and to do research on. So this is not a little project. And this is, These are violations of the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty, which very specifically states no country will make an agent that has the potential of being used for warfare that doesn't have some type of benefit for humanity. And this clearly doesn't have a benefit for humanity. It's a violation. It's treaty violation.
Okay, good. Are there any indications yet whether the virus's escape from the Wuhan laboratory was accidental or released for more nefarious and criminal reasons?
The information that we have shows that it was intentionally released.
Okay. Why?
To determine what it would do.
So they were willing, the Chinese were willing to release this, I assume hoping it could be contained, but see the input that this virus, modified virus, would have on local citizens.
I'm assuming
that would be the modus.
Okay. That's the information we have.
But then it got out of hand. Now, do you have any thoughts about the Swedish study out of the University of Lund claiming that the COVID vaccine RNA can be integrated and change a cell's DNA? That's according to what you had said earlier. And if this is the case, what are we looking at when we have in the United States somewhere around, I was told, 180 million vaccinated, and many of them vaccinated 2, 3, and 4 times? That's 4 different insertions of this biological material into their body. And in lay language, with the reverse transcriptase, is that then possible that individuals will now have the virus in its DNA, which can then change the person's DNA in ways that science has yet to determine, but none of it advantageous to the person and can cause us diseases, including and not limited to cancer?
Yeah, you know, we used to call these things back in the dark ages when I was a medical student, we used to call these oncoviruses, viruses that would cause cancer, and now we call them retroviruses. So you change the name, but it's still the same concept. Now, we showed, and we've got it on the website, where initially, almost 2 years ago, since we're already in April, that there was data that showed that the naturally occurring, naturally transmissible SARS-CoV-2 viruses was showing up with reverse transcribed genetic code inside the nucleus of human cells. We've also published some papers on there from more than a year ago now, where they showed that the genetic code was reverse transcribed into all but three human chromosomes. So we know out of the 21 sets that all but three of them have evidence of reverse transcription occurring. Now, I actually look at that as differently than many of my colleagues, because I think we can treat it. There is no data that shows that this virus prevents our repair mechanisms, our DNA repair mechanisms, from protecting our DNA. And so where many people are looking at treatment protocols for the people who have been vaccinated, and it is true that there is going to be long-term consequences of this. In fact, if you look at the CDC data, and I did a presentation and posted it on Rumble a few weeks ago, the CDC has done a very nice job. Probably weren't planning to help me out with this, but, you know, again, if you just look for the data, you can find it. The CDC data shows that people vaccinated and unvaccinated are showing long-term consequences of exposure either to the person-to-person transmission of this virus or the vaccines that they are being given. And remember, if it's happening from the vaccine, the only thing that they are technically supposed to be getting is the mRNA for the spike protein. Well, I would argue that's probably not all that's in there, because I would argue that there's some of the earlier components in the genetic sequences needed for the replication of this virus. It's called the replicase part in the open reading frame one. And I've shared data with people at presentations showing how that augments the immune response and the replication of what you're going for in a vaccine. So I think that's also in there, and they just haven't admitted to that yet. But the reality is, the CDC data shows that vaccinated and unvaccinated people are coming down with inflammatory thrombotic diseases. Just like I presented in the theory in 1994, the inflammation blood clotting. So they're coming up with all sorts of disease, heart disease, strokes, cancers, high blood pressure, diabetes, consequences of this inflammation blood clotting from the production of these spike proteins. And they're seeing a tremendous increase in Alzheimer's diseases and other prion diseases following on the heels of these vaccination sequences. So the CDC's own data shows that right on target, as we talked about back in the summer of 2021 at that event 2021 presentation I did in June, that the animal models, the mice, the humanized mice models and the rhesus macaque models showed that it would take about a year and a half for these prion diseases, these brain diseases and these inflammatory diseases in the body, to start showing up. And the CDC data shows that this is right on target. And it's more pronounced in the people over 45. It's more pronounced in Caucasians, in whites, and it's more pronounced in people that have been vaccinated. And when you look at that data, it's just the CDC collecting data confirming an increased incidence of these diseases and increased incidence of excess disease and death occurring on the heels of these vaccine programs. And the vaccines, we know, are causing pressure selection on the virus to cause a mutation of the variants. Go ahead. You have a question.
Okay, thank you. We don't have a lot of time left, but I need some shorter answers. You also have a background in physics, and you read this physics literature, and this may be something you can answer or not. But about a year ago, people were saying that they could put a magnet on their body where the vaccine was, and it would stick. And then we learned that some of the vaccines had graphite in it. And is there any evidence that that can adversely interfere with our body chemistry?
No, I don't. Graphene oxide has been used in the processing of vaccines for some time. We've looked at the vaccines under the microscope ourselves, and we've looked at the vaccines added to blood under the microscope. We're not seeing this massive amount of graphene.
Good. Okay, I'm glad. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. I'm going to share a hypothesis, and then we'll end our discussion with your answer. At the very beginning of this, I said that they've got it exactly backwards. They're vaccinating people who already have multiple and sometimes as many as four or five comorbidities, diabetes, heart disease, emphysema, etc. And that frequently these people are already at the end of their normal lifespan. They're in hospice care, hospitals, nursing homes, assisted living centers. And to give a person a vaccine, two vaccines, even three, you're going to overstimulate the immune system.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. At least 30 people have been killed and 100 injured in a Russian missile strike on a railway station in eastern Ukraine, where civilians were waiting for evacuation trains to safer regions of the country. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a speech today that the situation in the city of Borodyanka is much worse than in the Kiev suburb of Bucha, where over 300 people were tortured and killed. In Brussels yesterday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. was preparing to send even more advanced weaponry to Ukraine. The U.S. has sent Ukraine $1.7 billion in military aid since Russia invaded Ukraine 6 weeks ago. Peace activists say the focus should be on diplomacy. Code Pink's Medea Benjamin wrote, quote, Ukraine's foreign minister's agenda should not be weapons, 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 but negotiations, 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 and ceasefire, 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 close quote. Also yesterday, the United Nations General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the UN Human Rights Council. The U.S.-led push passed with 93 votes in favor, while 24 countries voted no and 58 countries abstained. The U.S. had announced it would seek Russia's suspension after Ukraine accused Russian troops of killing hundreds of civilians in the town of Bucha. The UN resolution suspending Russia expresses, quote, grave concern at the ongoing human rights and humanitarian crisis in Ukraine, particularly at the reports of violations and abuses of human rights and violations of international humanitarian law by the Russian Federation, close quote. Russia denies attacking civilians in Ukraine. Russia's UN ambassador said on Tuesday that while Bucha was under Russian control, quote, not a single civilian suffered any kind of violence, close quote. Alabama state lawmakers on Thursday passed a bill seeking to make it a crime to provide gender-affirming health care to transgender youth. Any medical provider found in violation could face up to 10 years in prison. The bill would also compel school personnel to disclose to the parent or legal guardian that a, quote, minor's perception of his or her gender or sex is inconsistent with the minor's sex, close quote. The American Civil Liberties Union called it the first bill of its kind to make health care for transgender youth a felony and said it would challenge the bill in court if Republican Governor Kay Ivey signed it into law. Ivey has not yet said she will do so. The American Academy of Pediatrics also opposes the bill and urged Ivey to veto it. Mainstream medical and mental health professionals say gender-affirming care saves lives by reducing the risk of depression and suicide. And more than 1,000 book titles, most addressing racism and LGBTQ issues, have been banned from U.S. classrooms and school libraries in the last 9 months, according to a new report from the writers' organization PEN America. PEN compiled a database of banned books that includes the first novel by Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison and a memoir by actor and activist George Takei about being sent to an internment camp in California as a Japanese-American child during World War II. PEN America says the widespread censorship is unparalleled in its intensity and frequency and represents a serious threat to free expression and students' First Amendment rights. Also this week, the American Library Association published its annual report on book censorship, revealing that it had tracked 1,597 book challenges or removals in 2021. That is the highest number recorded since the association began tracking the phenomenon 20 years ago. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 58 degrees and sunny. In New York City, 57 degrees, partly cloudy. From WPFW in Washington and WBA.